part right there. Oh man, I love that song. I love that song. You can just kind of feel the power in it, right? Just feel it. Now I know there's some of us in this room, we hear that song and we're like, yeah, let's go. I also want to recognize there's those of us in this room, we hear that song and you're like, I don't know if that God exists. I just want to say that's okay, man. I'm glad you're here no matter where you are. It's what we're talking about in this series is power. How do you get power? Now, the good news right off the gate is that no matter who you are, what you believe right now, maybe you're not even wondering if God's real, maybe you have no idea, it doesn't matter. The same power, God says, the same power that raised Christ from the dead is available to you. And my hope is that by the time you leave this experience, you've tasted it, you've accessed it, and you've tapped into it. Ephesians 1 says, I pray that you may know the hope to which he has called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in his holy people and his incomparably great power for us who believe. That power is the same as the mighty strength he exerted when he raised Christ from the dead. God says that power is available to you. The question is, how do you access that kind of power? How would you see it? One of the greatest displays of powers I've ever seen in my entire life was on a 4th of July. Not the fireworks, you know, that you're probably imagining, not the fireworks, it was actually before that, earlier in the day. A friend of mine had come over, and just for the sake of this story, just to protect his reputation, I'm gonna make him somewhat anonymous. We're just gonna refer to him as G. McElfresh. that might be too obvious. Let's go Greg M., okay? Greg M. came over with his family, and we were just gonna have a classic 4th of July, you know, just grilling two meats, ice cold beers, fireworks like the founding fathers intended. That was the plan for the day. After we got the kids all settled and doing their stuff, Greg was like, hey, Craig, come here. I got something. And he reaches into his back pocket and he pulls out an actual stick of dynamite. And I did what any red-blooded American male would do. I thought a lot about what we should do. And then I was like, let's blow that thing up. I got a bucket. We're going to put it under the bucket, and we're going to try to shoot the bucket to the moon like Apollo 11. That's what we're about to go do. So we went out to my yard, put the dynamite on this like place in the little field, put a bucket on top of it. And you might be wondering, did you wear eye protection? Did you get hearing protection? Did you check with your county to see if they require a permit or a license before detonating a stick of dynamite? Did you check with that same county to see, Kyle, before you tell us the story right now, what the statute of limitations is to see if you're incriminating yourself in this moment? Did you do anything that a reasonable adult could be expected to do? And the answer is no. Absolutely not. We lit the dynamite and then we just ran. I just hunkered down like, is that far enough? I hope so. I don't know. I've never exploded dynamite before. And we just waited. And right at the moment, we're like, I don't know if it's actually lit. The thing just goes boom and explodes. Now, if you've never put a stick of dynamite under a bucket before, let me just tell you, the bucket did not go up. The bucket went out in every single direction. There was bucket shrapnel coming down out of the sky like snow in July for like 10 minutes. It was beautiful. It was amazing. Also, I see there's some kids in the room, and so let me just step back for just a second. Hi, kids. I'm Uncle Kyle, and sometimes we adults, we tell adult stories for adult people, and I just want to be very clear that what we did was terribly irresponsible. It was horribly awesome. And I also want you to know you should never follow my advice for safety because I cut my finger in a table saw. That's a story for a different time. The point is, all of us love that big, sudden display of power. The thing that explodes, the firework that explodes in the air. But none of us, no matter what Katy Perry says, want to be a firework. We don't want anybody to look at our life and be like, yeah, it was just kind of a big, sudden boom, and then nothing, smoke in the wind. That kind of power has a name. We call it a flash in the pan. We don't want that. And in this series, as we're talking about power, the good news I have for you is that's not the kind of power we're talking about. That is the kind of power that we can achieve on our own. We have that inside of us, the power to be a flash in the pan. But what we're talking about in this series is the power to last, the power to be resilient. I think resilience is a characteristic that is dying in our world. It's getting rarer and rarer and rarer. The world says to us, just walk away when things get hard. When you have that big moment in your life, the big display of power, I mean, it's when you came to faith and you got baptized and everyone was cheering, everyone was clapping, the band was playing, it was just awesome. And you came out of the water and you just felt alive. And then a few months later, some things happened that you weren't excited about, some disappointments and some pain and some setbacks. You find yourself on the other side of those months and you wonder, was any of that real? How would you get this to last? Maybe you entered into a new relationship recently. It was amazing, it was beautiful, it was powerful. It just felt so connected. And then difficulty set in, hardship set in, disappointment set in. You realize that neither one of you is perfect. And you're wondering, is this gonna last? How would you be resilient? That's what we're talking about today, the power to last. I believe there's a secret in the Bible. And that secret has to do with what you fix your eyes on. Before we go any farther, I'm going to pray, and then we're going to catch you up on where we are in the Bible. God, would you be with us? I'm asking that you would help all of us, me included, take a step closer to you today, that no matter how we entered this room, feeling full of your power or feeling completely empty, that you would fill each and every one of us. Amen. The old man knew that the end was coming for him. His eyes had been fixed on the moment for a long, long time. It was an obsession that his friends thought was strange, a quirk in his personality. They just did not understand. But the man could see it, the end coming. It was the first thought he had every morning when he woke up. It was the last image in his mind as he went to bed. It was the dream that haunted him throughout the night. The end was coming for him, marching steadily closer and closer and closer. And now he knew in that way that passes knowing that the end would come very, very soon. Now, this wasn't the place that he would have picked to meet the end, if he had the pen to script his own life, but that was a delusion he had given up on a long, long time ago. He looked up at the stone walls of his cramped prison cell, smooth, orderly Roman concrete blocks called ashlar, made from volcanic ash that had fallen from the sky like black, fluffy snow, and then been compressed by time and pressure until it became something almost impossibly strong and hard. The man smiled at the thought, closed his eyes, and remembered the stone from the mountain range near his hometown where he grew up, the great Taurus Mountains, made of limestone, compressed sediment from ancient oceans long gone, packed and pressed by time until it too became something unbreakable, just like the walls of his prison cell, just like him. The man had been pressed and squeezed past the point of breaking, abandoned, shipwrecked, attacked, starved, arrested. More attempts had been made in his life than he could possibly count, though the scars lacing his tired old body tried to force him to come up with a number. Now, he didn't know if he'd meet the end today, tomorrow, next week, but he knew it was right around the corner. And he knew the sound that would reach his ears long before the approaching shadow got glimpsed by his eyes. It would be the faint clink of the keys hanging down from the jailer's belt, echoing down the long hallway. The old man closed his eyes, paused to listen. No keys. Not yet. He supposed that meant he'd have time to finish the letter he had begun that morning.
It'd be his last and a surprise to the world who followed his writing. Most of his letters have been written to major cities, Ephesus, Corinth, Philippi, even Rome. The Athenians probably thought that they would be next, and for good reason. But he had a much more important letter to write to a young man he had met more than a decade before, a young man who had to have the dream that he had, the dream of the end coming for him. Nothing was more important than that. Too many others had failed to catch the vision, failed to see the end coming, and because of that, they had fallen away and they were gone, like chaff blown off the threshing floor by the western wind. The old man turned back to the parchment, ink-stained fingers twirling the calamus pen until the words formed in his spirit, placed there by a power he knew no stone walls could ever contain. Yeah, these were the words. He was sure of it. And so he began writing. He said, "As for you, always be sober-minded, endure suffering, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. For I'm already being poured out as a drink offering. In the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith." He finished with a few personal instructions and greetings. He put the pen down, rubbed his tired eyes, and stretched his cramped legs. And that's when he heard it. The keys. The end was here. The old man grinned, relief flooding through his body. He had actually done it. The jailer in the hallway put his hand over his keys to silence them and leaned in and listened, straining an ear towards the end of the hallway in the old man's cell. Was that laughter? And he wondered, what kind of power did the old man know? Now, that old man went by the name Paul. He was a Roman citizen and a Jew, and he had been writing letters for decades that had shaped and changed the known world. Tens of thousands of lives have been upended by this guy's writing. But the last letter he ever wrote was to one guy, Timothy. It's a man he had met a long time ago, about a decade earlier. Timothy was probably 15 or 16 when he had met Paul in the city of Lystra in central Turkey. Timothy had been called into ministry. At this point, he had been serving the church of Ephesus for 4 years. Ephesus is a city on the northern Mediterranean coast. And Paul decided that this moment in Timothy's life, when Timothy is maybe 26 years old, at the beginning of his ministry, that this was the moment that Paul needed to call his eyes and his attention to the end of his life, to the end of everything. Odd. Why would he do that? This is the words he said to him, 2 Timothy 4:5. "But you be watchful in all things. Endure affliction," Paul wrote. "Do the work of an evangelist. Fulfill your ministry." Nowadays, we tend to use the word ministry to describe people like me. We say we're in ministry, professionally paid Christians to do church stuff. But that's not what the Bible means by ministry. Ministry is just the collection of good works that you were created to do. All of us have a ministry to fulfill, every single person. Paul wrote this in Ephesians 2:10. It says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." And so why would Paul write his last letter to a 20-something about ending well? Why not talk to him about how to begin well? How to survive the middle, how to really build your confidence, how to build your skills as a communicator. Why focus his attention on the end? Well, it's because many weren't ending well. This letter he wrote to Timothy, Paul mentioned 7 people by name who had been going after the ministry God had given them, and 6 did not end well. 2 Timothy 1:15, Paul writes, "This you know, that all those in Asia have turned away from me, among whom are Phygellus and Hermogenes." 2 Timothy 2:17, "Their teaching will spread like gangrene. Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, who have departed from the truth. 2 Timothy 4, for Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed for Thessalonica. Cretans for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. And now we know why we name kids Luke and not Phygelius, right there. That's 1 out of 7. Those odds aren't very good, and they're not much better right now. I saw a recent study talking about people who are in professional ministry, study of 3,000 of us, and it found that only 30% of us actually end well. Found another study that matched it, said that only 30% of children who grew up in a household of faith will have that faith survive all the way through their adult years. See, the fact is that all of us have a ministry that we're called to fulfill, but few fulfill and most don't. And you and I, we will be one or the other. We will. There's not a third option. There's not a kind of sort of option. You either do or you don't. Paul decided he wanted Timothy to be one who did, who fulfilled it. And I believe Paul's life holds the secret for how. Now, my impression of Paul changed dramatically a number of years ago. I got to go on a trip where I toured with one of the world's leading experts on Paul. We went through Turkey, we went through Greece, we visited Corinth and Ephesus and Philippi to understand the man and what he was doing and his motivations and the truths in his writing. It was profoundly impactful to me. Before the trip, if you'd said, describe Paul, I would have said, he's kind of like an egghead guy. I picture a classroom, just like a real intellectual. Well, and there's a reason for that. Paul was brilliant. He was super brilliant. He wrote the letter Romans. Romans was actually used in Harvard when Harvard was founded, not as a spiritual document, but as a training tool for students in the law school to look at how do you argue? How do you debate? How do you reason? Paul was 100% brilliant. But if you view Paul as an egghead, you miss the man and you miss the lesson of his life because being brilliant was not the defining trait of Paul's life. Being resilient was the defining trait. Paul was born in Tarsus in central Turkey. He was an ethnic minority. There was about 100,000 people in the city. He was a Jew. There's about 3,000 of them. So he was one of the 3% in his city. From there, he went to Jerusalem to study under the Pharisee Gamaliel. Not Garmadon, by the way. That's different. Garmadon's from Ninjago, for parents out there. Or Gargamel from the Smurfs. Different guy. Just want to be clear. Gamaliel. And said he's there, he decides as a Pharisee that when the Christians come around, they are wrong and his job is to persecute them and stop them. And so he literally hunts down Christians and has them executed. One day he's going from Jerusalem up north to Damascus. And in the middle of the road, as he's on his travels, a bright light comes out of the sky. A voice shouts at him. He's knocked down onto the ground, him and everyone with him. And the voice says, Paul, I'm Jesus. Why are you persecuting me? And Paul's life immediately changes. Immediately changes. That sudden burst of power that you and I have experienced in our life and our faith, when we came to faith, when we first had the gospel click inside of us, or first felt it during a worship song, or felt it in a moment, that Paul has that moment. It's big and it's huge and it's amazing. Acts 9:20. Immediately he preached the Christ in the synagogue is that he is the Son of God. Immediately. And what happens to us? Happened to Paul, immediately he encountered resistance. The big thing, the big awesome, the big moment, it happens and then it gets really, really hard. He starts preaching the gospel in Damascus and they try to kill him. Literally try to kill him. So he flees, he goes back down south, he goes to Jerusalem, he meets with the disciples, he starts preaching the gospel there and again, it does not go well. They also try to kill him. It gets so dangerous that the disciples actually send him in a basket out a hole in the wall at night out of the city and say, you should go home to Tarsus, Paul. And so he does. He goes back to Tarsus. We don't know how long it's been since he had been there. Probably quite a while. Like I said, he had left in his youth to study as a Pharisee in Jerusalem. He gets back there. If his family were still in town, they would have rejected him wholeheartedly. Paul now believes something they consider to be worthy of him being put to death. If he had been married, we don't know. His wife would have abandoned him, would have left him. So this expert that I toured with, he said, you know, I think the most reasonable explanation of what Paul did when he was in Tarsus is he likely lived as an outcast in a cave outside the town alone for 8 years. Can you imagine? Can you imagine having that moment that when things kind of click together? I just stepped into the career I think was made for me, and then stuff gets hard. Could you wait for 8 years? Can you imagine getting into a relationship or a marriage? You step into it, it's amazing, it's so great, and things get hard for 8 years. Would you stay? Can you imagine crossing the line of faith, getting baptized, saying yes, going on the go trip, it's amazing, it's so great, whatever, and then 8 years of hardship follow? What would you do? What Paul did is Paul stayed. He just stayed. See, the secret power that resilient people have that the rest of us don't is they stay. You know that phrase? You can complete the sentence. When the going gets tough, the tough... No, they don't. They stay. Paul stayed. After 8 long years, Barnabas, one of his old buddies, comes up and gets him and says, hey, everyone's excited, Paul. It's been long enough. Stuff's cooled down. Come on back to Jerusalem. And so Paul goes back to Jerusalem. And from there, Paul's life is just, man, it is hashtag blessed. I mean, everything is up and to the right. There is no problems. I read this from Acts 4:04. It says, from there, Paul's life was full of lollipops and unicorns. Every day he woke up with a double rainbow, and every night he laid his head down on a baby soft pillow of fully realized dreams. Paul's life. No, that's not what happened at all. He experienced hardship. But this is the delusion we have, right? That if something was gonna last, it was meant to last, if we were supposed to stick it out, if we were supposed to exercise power, it would be easier. It wouldn't be hard. We have this illusion that this is how life goes. Amazing, and then it followed by infinite amazingness. No, that's not how it works at all. There's a moment that pulls you in, but it's to set your eyes, to fix your eyes on something that you can walk through the difficulty that's sure to come. Not likely, sure to come. These are Paul's words about what actually happened next. 2 Corinthians 11, 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned, 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I was adrift at sea on frequent journeys in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, and toil and hardship through many a sleepless night, and hunger and thirst, often without food, and cold and exposure. And apart from all the other things, there's the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who's weak and I'm not weak? Who is made to fall and I am not indignant? Indignant means I feel like I've been treated unfairly. That's what it means. Paul's saying, do you really think I endured all this? And I didn't have moments where I went like, really, God? Where's my purpose-driven life? I thought I was supposed to follow you. It was going to be all, really? You think I didn't have those moments? He goes, of course. Of course. Everyone does. Everyone hears the whispers of the world saying, walk away. Stop. I've heard him in my life. I've heard him in my marriage. We had 3 kids in 3 years. We were so tired and angry. I guarantee you, there were many moments when Sarah looked at me and went, that guy? Forever? In my job, I've heard that voice here. I was in the same job for 7 years in a row. I was actually told at one point that I was doing too good of a job to be advanced. You think I didn't want to quit? You think I didn't feel overlooked? Of course, of course. I've heard that voice in my faith. I've had the moment that you've had where you pray for someone to be healed. You say, God, would you give my friend, would you give my loved one a miracle? Would you heal them? And instead of getting a miracle, what I get is an invitation to a funeral. And you go, really? Is this it? We all have heard this voice. But the amazing thing about Paul is that Paul was resilient. Paul tapped into a power, somehow found a power that allowed him to push through all of that. If you want a picture for Paul, it's not a classroom, it's a mountain range. This is a recreation of the Taurus mountain range that Paul would have hiked over many times as he climbed through this ancient world of Turkey in Greece. He would have scaled mountains. The reason he was hungry and tired is he was on the top of a mountain. The reason that he was cold is because he was way up in the snow. There were bandits in the passages that would attack him, and he kept going again and again and again. By the way, it is, yes, if you've heard it several times, the Taurus mountain range, like the Ford Taurus. You've seen that car. Remember that car from the 90s? Looked like this, just like a mountain range probably. It's probably what you always pictured. No, not sure why they named it that. Very ambitious for it. Anyway, nothing could stop Paul. Nothing could stop Paul. He actually wrote this in 2 Corinthians. He said, "We are hard pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed." How? Well, the world says the way to be resilient is to focus yourself and your attention on your problems, in your pain points, in your setbacks, and to think about them and talk about them and obsess over them. If Paul were alive today, you know what we'd do with him? We'd say, "Paul, you've experienced something many times called trauma, and you're gonna go spend the rest of your life in therapy. That's what you're gonna go do. So we'll see you later. We'll throw you a birthday party or something at the end of it." But like that, like you, clearly you're too broken, Paul. That's too much. But that's not what Paul does. There's actually not a single verse in the Bible. There's not a single thing in anything that Paul ever wrote that sounds like focus on your problems. Because when you stare at something, you become that thing. Do you know that? 1 John says that we will be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Meaning we'll be like Jesus one day because we'll have stared at him for so long. We'll see him as he actually is. And in that moment, we'll be transformed. What you stare at is what you become. If you stare at your problems, your life will become a series of problems. That's not what Paul does. Instead, what Paul does is Paul fixes his eyes on one thing, the end. Now, the end is actually a name for Jesus. I don't know if you knew that. Connect a couple dots here for you. Hebrews 12 says, "Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith." Revelation 21:6 says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end." See, when you focus on the end, when Paul's in the prison cell, and he's dreaming of the end, he's thinking about the end, he's writing to Timothy about fulfilling his ministry, about ending well, Paul is imagining Jesus. That's why he's happy when he shows up. It's why he's excited. The end is here. See, Paul said the best thing you can do to fulfill your ministry is to imagine the end of your life. There's like a finish line, so to speak. And just across the finish line is Jesus going, "Come on, you can do it. Come on, you're almost there. Come on, let's go." And you imagine yourself crossing that line in stride and him saying, "Great job." You fix your eyes on the end. Now, that's something of an abstract thought, a little bit difficult to picture in your mind. I think Paul knew that. And so Paul, in this letter to Timothy and throughout the rest of his writings, has three dominant metaphors for us to grasp and to fix in our mind. He wrote to Timothy about them in 2 Timothy 2. He said, "No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. Also, if anyone competes in athletics, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. The hardworking farmer must be first to partake of the crops. Consider what I say, and may the Lord give you understanding in all things." Soldier, the athlete, the farmer. Paul's all-time top three favorite metaphors. I'm gonna go through them. And my guess is that one of these is gonna stick out to you in your life. Now, they're meant to be things that we can attach to throughout our life in different seasons, but one of these is gonna jump out to you today, and I want you to remember the image, I want you to fix it in your mind, and then we're gonna have a conversation with God about it at the end. First is the farmer. The farmer fixes their eyes on the finish line of the harvest, and the Lord of the harvest, one of the other names for Jesus, at the end saying, "Great job." And because of that, they have the ability to wait and work. Paul said the hardworking farmer must be first to partake of the crops. The farmer is first. They wake up first. They go to bed first. They get to work first. And you think about a farmer, most of their life, most of their energy, when they're tilling and they're planting and they're weeding and they're working on machinery and they're fixing stuff, most of the time throughout the whole year, you know what they see in the ground? Nothing. Nothing. It's just a bunch of dirt. So the farmer has to have the mentality, has to imagine what it will be like when the seeds burst out of the ground and grow up and produce fruit and they can actually have a harvest. They must focus on that every single day. Otherwise, they just wouldn't work. The power of the farmer is the power to not give up. Galatians 6, Paul wrote, "A man reaps what he sows. Let us not become weary in doing good. For at the proper time, we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Maybe there's a season in your life where you don't see any fruit. It's nothing above the surface, just dirt, nothing else. Maybe it's your career, your marriage, maybe it's your faith, I don't know. But if that's where you're at, my encouragement to you is to fix your eyes on the farmer, to take the mentality of the farmer, to ask God to give you the power of resilience that the farmer has. And next is a soldier. The soldier fixes their eyes on victory and on the champion of our faith, another name for Jesus, the leader and commander of angel armies, saying, good job. And because of that, the soldier uniquely has this ability to please their commanding officer. Paul wrote, no one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. So the soldier isn't about pleasing themselves. They don't wake up every day and go, man, what do I want to do? I think I'm just going to hang out. No. What do? They drill and they practice and they work and they obey commands, whether they think it's going to be good for them and safe for them or not. That's what a soldier does. This is the image that God put into my mind at the very beginning of my ministry, not my professional ministry, not when I entered in to work at Crossroads or anything, but when I actually said, God, I believe you have good works prepared for me and I want to do all of them. About that same time in my life, God gave me this picture of a soldier out of another of Paul's writings, Ephesians 6. Paul wrote, therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand or be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Just picture this soldier at the end of their life, not a young soldier, not a soldier who's never seen battle, but a soldier who's seen battle after battle after battle, has the scars to prove it, and yet gets the end of their life, walks up to their commanding officer, looks up in their eyes and said, I'm still here, I'm still standing, I'm ready for the next assignment where you can call me home to eternity. I'm good either way. I'm still standing. It's the only reason I didn't quit. It's the only reason I didn't walk away. So I had that fixed in my mind, burned in my spirit, placed there by God, the image of the soldier. Maybe you're at a point in your life where you're tempted to please yourself. Maybe you're living a life you know pleases yourself. Maybe you don't even believe in God yet, but there's something in you that you know that you're doing, a pattern that you're doing, something that you know is destructive, you know isn't helpful, it's just to please yourself. If that's where you are, you have a conversation with God about the soldier. Last is the athlete. The athlete fixes their eyes on the prize and the champion of the faith at the end, putting the crown of victory on their head. And because of that, they have the ability and the power to enter into strict training. Now, speaking of athletics, the Olympics are coming back this summer. Paris Olympics, cannot wait. I love watching the Olympics. So good, so great. Now, I would be more excited, though, if they would do my idea. And I don't mean to brag or anything, but I think this is the best idea I've ever had in my whole entire life. Now, here's the idea. Starts with the problem. Problem is, we all watch the Olympics, right? And we see these world-class athletes who we know are so fast and so strong and so talented compete against each other. And the problem with that is that what we really want to know is how much stronger and faster and more talented are they than us? Well, we can't tell. They're running against each other. And so my idea, what I want to see, is that in each and every Olympic event, we add an average guy lane. That's what I want. Now, average, not prepared. If you're prepared, you're not average. I'm not talking about that. It'd have to work like this. The loudspeaker goes on right before the race. It's like, section 302, row 49, seat D. I think your name is Daryl. Daryl, are you there? Daryl's 2.5 Mick Ultras in. He's smashing nachos into his face just like we would be doing. And Daryl's us, you know what I mean? Daryl's the kind of guy that's like, if the remote's all the way on the other side of the couch, we'll just keep the channel where it is. That's Daryl. Daryl's got to go down there like, Daryl, you're running the 800. Get in there, man. Let it rip. He's pulling his hammy, you know, 100 meters in. He's like, oh, got to hobble, Daryl. We don't quit, Daryl. Keep going, Daryl. Think about the high dive, right? It's like 9 stories tall. people would be building houses up there. They would just refuse to jump off. And then we would know. It'd be so much more impressive. So if you have a connection to NBC or whatever, pass along my idea and just tell them you're welcome, okay? Point is, no athlete reaches the Olympics being average. That's who gets there. Average people don't get there. In fact, I don't mean to have low self-esteem, okay? But I gotta be honest with you guys, I don't think I'm gonna make the Olympics this year. I just don't think it's in the cards. I mean, I work out 2-3 times a week, sometimes 4. I drink Diet Coke. Occasionally a light beer. Made a friend with a vegan, you know, just for health reasons. Trying to take care of myself. But I don't think that's gonna be enough. When the Olympics come on, we'll see all these little mini biopics about the athletes and how they grew up, and they'll interview their parents and their coaches and those pictures of them as a kid. But what we will never see in any of those, I promise, is a picture of 10-year-old Johnny on the couch, bowl of Cheetos on his stomach, just flipping them in the air. You're not gonna hear a parent or a coach say, yeah, I got no idea how Johnny made the Olympics. He's the laziest kid I know. It's not gonna happen. People who do average stuff do not make the Olympics, do not get crowned with victory. My question for you, is there anything in your life that looks like strict training when it comes to you and God? Paul wrote this in 1 Corinthians 9. Do you not know that in a race all runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do a crown that will last forever. What looks like strict training? If that's convicting to you, ask God to fix your mind, fix your eyes on the end, the way that an athlete would, the picture of victory and crossing the finish line, the champion of faith, placing the crown on your head. Ask him to give you the power of resilience of the athlete. Now, all three of these have the same general picture. Fix your eyes on the end. And this is Paul's secret. This is what enabled him to go through difficulty after difficulty and setback after setback and never once stop. This is how. Now, the good news is that God wants to give you this power. He does. This power isn't reserved for people who've done it all right. And I want to be very clear, too. This is not a self-help message. This is not a thing that where I'm saying, man, well, all you gotta do is just work up the resolve inside of yourself. Just really promise God that this time it's gonna be different. Really promise God that this time you're not gonna do that thing. Really promise God that you're gonna do everything you can to follow him. Don't do that. Instead, say to God, I don't have the power it takes. Would you give it to me? You know, Jesus says in Luke 11 that everyone who asks receives. Receives what? The power of the Holy Spirit. You can ask God for it. You can ask him for it. Maybe you messed up. Maybe you gave up a long time ago. Maybe you've already quit and you're thinking, man, it's too late. This would have been great to have this message when I was Timothy's age, 25 years old. That'd be great. Too late for me. No, it's not. Maybe you got knocked down, but you can get back up. You're not at the end yet. You can still fulfill the ministry that God has called you to. You can if you ask him for his power. So we're gonna do right now. I know the alarm bells are going off in your head and you're thinking like, I gotta get to mulching, Kyle. I mean, it's a really important weekend in my life. I gotta really go mulch. I'm just gonna say, let mulch wait for 2 more minutes. If this message is just something that you came and it was fine or enjoyed it or whatever, and that's it, doesn't matter. Doesn't do any good. Wasted your time. We need this message to go from our heads into our hearts and have a conversation with God. We're gonna take just 2 minutes and do that right now. Close your eyes. I want you to call to mind the picture that sticks out to you the most. Maybe it's the farmer. Maybe it's the soldier. Maybe it's the athlete. Whichever it is, have a conversation with God right now about that image. If there's something you want to apologize for, you can apologize, ask forgiveness. Good news is when you ask for forgiveness, God's answer is always, yeah, I forgive you. And then ask God for the power of the farmer to wait. Ask God for the power of the soldier to seek to please the commanding officer over themselves. ask for God for the power of the athlete to run the race with endurance and to enter into strict training. Let me pray for you. God, I thank you that you do not hold on to your power for your own, but you give it to us, that the same power that coursed through Jesus can course through us. Would you give us that power, God, for everybody who's asked, say yes and fill us with your power to fulfill the ministry that you've called us to. Amen.